Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Tamara. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Two major recent releases have gotten us looking back and thinking about some classic old funk recordings from the 1970s. Let me explain. Kendrick Lamar has his brand new album out called To Pimp a Butterfly, and D'Angelo, at the end of 2014, released his long-awaited album, Black Messiah. Now, what do these records have in common? Well, they actually have quite a lot in common. They're seismic, important albums from two of today's most vital artists, and they both address glaring social issues like race and class. So there's a lot to unpack in both records, but let's talk about how these records sound. Because in numerous places on both of these records, like Kendrick's King Kunta,
now I run a game, got the whole world talking King Kunta. Everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no loss.
Or D'Angelo's Back to the Future.
Traveling at the speed of light and then at the same time I'm in.
You can hear the sonic footprint of one man, Dr. Funkenstein himself, George Clinton. With so much of George's legacy and that of his bands, Parliament and Funkadelic, in the air, we thought it would be a good time to revisit a conversation I had with George Clinton late last year. This was just after the release of his wild and wily autobiography with the memorable title of Brothers Be Yo Like George, Ain't That Funkin' Hard on You? George, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks. Glad you had me here. I've been de-fleed, de-ticked, and I got my rabies shot, and I'm ready to bury the bone. It's the dog in me.
Now, I got to start with the title. You know, Brothers Be Yo Like George, Ain't That Funkin' Kinda Hard on You? It's not every memoir that has as its title a kind of existential question. Has funkin' that hard been hard on you?
I say I was hard when I started. I'll be hard when I get through. And in the meantime, it's been a challenge.
Yeah.
But challenges, without humps, there'd be no getting over.
Right. So how are you feeling these days? Are you feeling like you've been through the wars?
Oh, no, I feel good. 73, I got something to fight for, so I enjoy and welcome, you know, all that we're going through because I think we found a way of getting the problems out to the people in the book.
Mm-hmm.
On page 379, that is my reason for writing the book, you know, in the
All
first
right.
place.
Let's be specific here. What's on page 379?
Well, it's 379 and a few more pages after that.
After that, yes.
Okay, it's the sworn statement of a lady, Jane Peters, in Switzerland, in the Swedish embassy, testifying that she done all these illegal things, you know, on behalf of Bridgeport Music, BMI, and the other record companies.
Right.
Okay. Her testimony is on 379, on, and it's a legal document, so I don't have to go through screaming all of that. She said it herself.
So, you know, at the end of the day, this is a story of music, of course, of you finding your path through an industry that is full of sharks.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, at 73, feeling like you've created a body of work and maybe haven't been completely recompensed for it.
And not only that, trying to take it permanently from my heirs. That's the main problem.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I was doing what I did and got me in trouble, you know. I was out there. I was crackhead. Everybody know that. That got me in trouble, but not to the point where they can take it from my heirs
right.
permanently. And that's what I'm fighting for.
Well, okay. And your heirs will have your story, as best you remember it.
Oh, yeah.
Which
yeah.
is apparently pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
In this book, which, you know, starts from the beginning, growing up, Newark, the barbershop, the early band.
Doo-wop songs, Frankie Lyman.
So before there was Parliament, before there was Funkadelic, there was the Parliaments. And that was...
I just want to testify what your love has done for me. Lonely Island, poor Willie.
So this was, you know, we're talking about the era where the Brill Building is ascendant, you know,
and
the great American songbook is still being written.
Yes. I worked at the Brill Building.
So in 1958, when you and the Parliaments, when you were 17, you recorded this song, Poor Willie. How experienced were you at writing and kind of performing?
Not at all. We just made up songs there. And we recorded the song on a session with the Elegants. It did Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Star, how I wonder where you are. Wish I may, wish I might. Make this wish come true tonight.
They went on to become a million seller. We was on that same session.
Really?
And we got that close to a hit record. And then our neighbors, the Monotones, did Who Wrote the Book of Love.
Who wrote the book of love?
Everybody in the neighborhood was getting hit records all around us.
This is in Newark.
This is in Newark, right. And, you know, Sarah Vaughan, I did Living Milk to her. All of that, I was going to the Brill Building. And I didn't get the job at the Brill Building until 60, when JoBette opened up, which is part of Motown.
JoBette Publishing.
Publishing, right.
But 1958 is when you recorded this song. Let's hear a very young George Clinton. This is even before he joins the Brill Building as a songwriter and his early group, The Parliaments. George Clinton was 17. There was no Parliament, no Funkadelic, but there was the Parliaments and the song Poor Willie. When's the last time you heard that?
I can't remember.
And what's it like hearing this?
Without flashbacks, I probably wouldn't have no memory at all. You know, but it sounds good. You know, at that time we was on the coaster tip. The coasters was the big thing, you know, the singing the four-part harmony. And it don't sound as bad as I thought it would.
It sounded pretty good, yeah. Now, by this time, I mentioned you were 17. You were already a dad. You were already married. And, you know, to make money, you worked at the Hula Hoop factory. And I say, I use the word worked loosely.
it was loosely, too, because we ran the Hula Hoop factory, you know. They came in our neighborhood out of nowhere in a panic, ready to sell these hula hoops. And, for lack of a better word, our gang was telling them, we'll get the hula hoops made for you, but y'all not going to just open up and da da. And they pretty much let us run it. And we got all the little kids to do the work. 8, 9 years old, because they had fun running, putting the hoops together, and we just staple them. We wouldn't get them a staple gun. And we all punched in and went home.
Right.
And let the kids work all day. And we come back, and we got so many hula hoops done so fast. They had to get another building to store them.
So that was your first major contribution to American pop culture, was
right.
Churning out those hula
turning
hoops.
Turning out hula hoops.
Because the 8 and 9-year-old kids thought it was fun to put them together, and you thought it was fun to get
paid
for it.
Right.
Well, fortunately, the whole child labor thing didn't last too long. Now, you head into the 60s. You mentioned you went to the Brill Building, Jobet Publishing, which was an arm of Motown. It wasn't just Motown. You always had an eye for what was happening in the rock world, the Beatles and the Stones and Dylan.
One of my partners in 59-6 was named Jimmy Miller. He went on to England after I got the job at Jobet. He went on with a group called Spooky Tooth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And
that was Gary Weaver's, Dream Weaver. Gary,
right.
Now I'm forgetting his name, but you know who I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, right. Okay. He had that group. He also had Spencer Davis. Give Me Some Lovin'.
Right.
And I'm a man.
And it's Gary Wright.
Right, Gary Wright, right. And he went on to, you know, become the Rolling Stone producer.
Right, right.
That was my partner in 60. So I had a real close relationship with what was coming out of Europe later on when I started hearing Cream do Spoonful, Crossroads, just the music my mother used to listen to.
So and you heard that music, that great black music coming back
here,
from the
right.
other side
and
of
I
the
was
Atlantic.
Kinda, I was kind of embarrassed not to know Robert Johnson, who he was. You know, I knew the music, but I heard Eric Clapton explaining who Robert Johnson was, giving him props, and I felt like, I can't let this happen again, not know my own music, because we figured rock and roll and blues was white music by this time. We didn't even realize that it had been my mother's music. I knew that, but, you know, you're not thinking. So we said we got to find our niche in this time period, which was funk.
Song Good Old Music by the Parliaments from 1968. I mean,
that take me back.
Yeah. Now, hard to imagine that is the same band that did Poor Willie 10 years earlier.
Right.
Completely different sound.
We was outright announcing that we were here. You know, right after Testify, which was the big single that we got in 66, we realized we had been too late getting there. Because as soon as we got that, it flipped over into the psychedelic beads and, you know, the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelins and everybody started coming. We realized we were late with the doo-wop. I'm not necessarily doo-wop, but the Motown sound.
Mm.
So we had to change again. And, okay, that's when I figured out it's got to be something funky. So Music for My Mother was announced that here we are. Music from way back up in the woods.
Right.
Matter of fact, all the way in the jungle. We weren't even going back to slavery. We was going back primal.
So Music for My Mother being the name of the album.
The album, which sounded like psychedelic versions of the songs that my mother would listen to.
Yeah.
Which is what Cream was doing.
Absolutely.
With rock and roll.
With the old Robert Johnson blues and
right.
stuff. So this really is kind of like a watershed moment. This is where the doo-wop, the Motown, gives way to what you, George Clinton, have become known for, which is P-Funk, Parliament, Funkadelic.
Right. That's the first record we used our little brother's, the band Funkadelic, on. We didn't call them Funkadelic, but it was the first record we actually used the musicians from Plainfield, New Jersey,
right.
with us.
Okay, so now, George, you go through the whole story in the book about how you end up with these kind of two parallel bands, Parliament and Funkadelic. I still don't understand it. How do they evolve into separate but related things?
Well, by the time You know, after that record right there, the record company went out of business, so we couldn't use the name Parliament. So we took our little brothers, called them Funkadelic. We became their backup singers, and we could do them legally, put a record out as Funkadelic, you know, and be their backup singers. And legally we can get away with it with the union and everything. So now we got Funkadelic and Parliament was quiet for a minute. Then we got a deal with Holland Dozier Holland.
The songwriting team.
Yeah, for Motown. They opened a label called Invictus. We started Parliament back again a couple of years later, and now it's Parliament.
Without the S.
Without the S.
No longer named after a brand of cigarettes.
No, just we stepped up the time.
Right,
so
right.
Now you got Parliament and Funkadelic. You got a record called Osmium, and you got a record called, at that time, might have been Maggot Brain.
Right.
For Funkadelic.
And Parliament is more the kind of R&B pop band.
Yes.
And Funkadelic is the rock band.
Yeah, the psychedelic, you know, like Free Your Mind, Your Ass Will Follow, you know, Jimi Hendrix times 10.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So this leads to one of the interesting things about Funkadelic is it's a black band playing rock music at a time when the music world is really beginning to see rock as a white thing.
Underground, not only white, but underground.
Yeah.
Even some white groups couldn't get into that category. If you wasn't an underground band, you had to be a hit and not a hit at the same time, which was like you sold albums, but you
right.
wasn't on the top 40. But, you know, you was a sellout if you did that.
Right.
So Funkadelic strived hard to become underground. We made records that we didn't want to be played on radio.
Well, and you write at one point that, you know, you were too white for the black audience.
And too black for the white.
And that,
white
that's
audience.
How you wanted it.
Yeah, because the fans that liked it us no matter what stayed.
Right.
They were smaller, but they grew over time. And I realized that I can actually start a movement like this and just have, I mean, Frank Zappa was like that. You know what I'm saying? You have your fans that liked you for you and no matter what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed that way for the longest, you know, playing the underground things.
So who was the audience? When you went out on stage, assuming
college
you were
kids,
in... Yeah.
College kids from black or white schools.
Okay.
I mean, Maggot Brain was crossed the line for the people that liked us. And then we played, like, Europe, it blew up over there. And so when we came back home, we had that underground audience, same way they do on the internet nowadays. You have bands that come over YouTube,
right.
And it's the new thing. That's what we became until we got the hit record Up for the Downstroke as part of it.
This is another kind of big change because
yeah,
this was a hit. So
Bootsy came in. So Parliament, we reached for hit records. That was the thing about Parliament. We tried to be commercial.
Right. So Funkadelic, you wanted to sell albums and keep your street cred.
Right. Right. Keep your street cred. That's right. Parliament, we needed to eat. You need to be able to make money.
Right.
I just tell the Chili Peppers that. It can be psychedelic indeed, but you want one or two songs in there that radio can play. Mm-hmm. Up for the Downstroke was one of those because we got Bootsy with us from James
That's
Brown Band.
Bootsy Collins, yeah.
Bootsy Collins came from James Brown Band. So it's easy to make that dance music because I knew that from the Motown days. I knew how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
We just hadn't desired to do it. But when we got him, and he brought Fred Wesley and Maceo Parker from the JBs. So now we can do songs like Sly Stone is doing, like James Brown is doing, you know, with the horn section. What I chose to do, though, was since Bernie was a classical keyboard player.
That's Bernie Worrell.
Worrell. I did songs like James Brown, but put classical piano over. I overdid it. You know, I just let Bernie go crazy with his jazz and classical against the James Brown funk.
Mm-hmm.
And I just talked. I just talk Chocolate City, you know, Up for the Downs. I mean, we just made commercial songs for the time period. Black and Proud was in. That was the end thing.
Right.
After the 60s, you know, the civil rights and everything, it was cool to be black.
Right.
So we did Chocolate City. This made it ultra black, and that was like, okay.
Inspired by something you had read that showed that Washington, D.C.
was 80%
like,
black.
Yeah.
Wow, we got the ballot. We don't need the bullet if you got the ballot.
Yeah.
That was my theory, and that was where I went with Ali being in the White House.
Right,
know,
right.
So you know, Aretha
Richard
Franklin,
Pryor Richard in the Price, cabinet.
Stevie Wonder. I just imagine the whole cabinet,
right.
You know, of us in there funking around.
A blood to blood, a players to ladies. The last percentage count was 80. You don't need the bullet when you got the ballot. Are you up for the downstroke, CC? Chocolate City. Are you with me out there? And when they come to march on you, tell them to make sure they got their James Brown pass. And don't be surprised if Ali is in the White House. And Reverend Ike, Secretary of the Treasury. Richard Pryor, Minister of Education. Stevie Wonder, Secretary of Fine Arts. And Miss Aretha Franklin, the First Lady. Are you out there, CC? A Chocolate City is no dream. It's my piece of the rock. And I dig you, CC. God bless Chocolate City and its vanilla suburbs. Can y'all get to that?
That's a little bit from Chocolate City from the band Parliament, part of the P-Funk Collective, Parliament Funkadelic, all revolving around my guest George Clinton, the singer, songwriter, and author of the new memoir called Brothers Be, Yo Like George, Ain't That Funkin' Kinda Hard on You. He's with me here in the Soundcheck studio, and George, the idea of you as the center, the focus, the driving force in Parliament Funkadelic, that was something you had to be talked into, as it turns out.
Oh, yes. We wanted to be a democracy. You know, we always felt like we were all the same as one group and Democratic, and we did everything. But Neil Bogart, who was the owner of Casablanca Records, who I had wanted to be with for years because he was a good promotion man and he knew marketing, he would do it if I would be the center of attraction.
Mm.
And I was reluctant to do that because that wasn't our style. But I had heard that once before from Dave Kaplick, who was Sly Stone's manager. And he was our manager, too. But he thought that it was too dark. You know, you couldn't distinguish no focal point in the band. So when Neil said it, I said, two people done said that. And I trust me more than I trust anybody else doing that. So I reluctantly said yes, and that became Dr. Funkenstein.
Right. And when Bootsy Collins joins the band, of course, he's a big personality.
He's a personality.
As well.
So we couldn't even keep him in the band. He was so much a personality. He couldn't be in Funkadelic or Parliament. We just gave him his own band.
The Rubber Band.
The Rubber Band.
Yeah.
And I told him, you help me do Parliament with this bass playing that you got. I'll help you do whatever group you got. And we made up the name right here in New York, walking up and down the street.
Yeah. So Neil Bogart tells you there's got to be a focal point and it's got to be you. But Neil also has a role to play in the most famous kind of bit of stagecraft.
The mothership. When I told him after we got the hit record, We Want the Funk, Tear the Roof Off, I told him, you know, you don't get paid for records in the tail end anyway. But you can get help from promotion. Buy me this spaceship. And I will be able to, I ain't have to finish it. As soon as I said it, he went and got me a loan from the bank, First LA Bank, and got me a loan for $1 million. We bought at Jules Fisher right here in New York City, built the spaceship. Larry Gatsby did the costuming. And we was off on a play. We were taking a funk opera, is what we was calling it.
Kind of a sci-fi.
Yeah.
I mean, you were into science fiction.
Yeah. And so he got the spaceship.
First, describe what the spaceship, I mean, was it built to your specifications?
Oh, yes. We and Jules Fisher, Bill, I told him we want to be able to land it on the stage. I get out of it on the stage. We had two of them. One would fly over the people's head.
Right, a smaller one.
And go behind these giant denim hat and glasses and disappear. Then the big one would come out of the hat, and it was like 50 feet long. So, and you know it's in the Smithsonian right now, too.
Well, I thought, you know, the actual mothership, there was some mystery of
second,
where it is.
But the first one, they tore it apart and sold pieces all over the place.
But the second one's in
the Smithsonian. We had another one built and performed in Central Park here on the 20th anniversary of the mothership. We had another, same guy, same blueprint. Everything.
So it kind of looked like a combination lunar module from the from Apollo.
Oh, you saw it for real.
Yeah. Mixed with like weird ancient Egyptian symbology or something like that.
I mean,
that.
He had that concept. We were talking about Egypt and the pyramids and all of that in the record. So he made it not only the spaceship, he built us a giant pyramid. Mm-hmm. All that was on the stage, Jules Fisher did. And the spaceship actually flew at its Madison Square Garden here. We landed it, and I just got a picture of that last night. We landed at 5 o'clock in the morning, right in Times Square, right in front of the Coca-Cola sign there.
Yeah. When is this?
With no permit. In like 77.
Well, you know, Times Square in 77, probably nobody batted an eyelash.
It was 5 o'clock in the morning. The only person that came out was Murray D.K.
The DJ.
He met us out there. He was ripped. He was drunk, is he? He ripped. He said, "Dr. Funkenstein, welcome to planet Earth. I am Mary D.K., the fifth Beatle."
Grooving. You gotta hit the bang. All right. Star Child here. Put a glide in your stride and a dip in your hip and come on to the mothership. Loose boot, doing the bump. Hustle on over here.
So the mothership, becomes kind of a key part of the stagecraft of the Parlin Funkadelic universe.
Transported us for 10 years.
Yeah.
All the way up to Atomic Dog. We were still using
But it wasn't just the mothership, as it turns out. I was unaware of just how important your little pet pig, Dibbles, was to the kind of the touring scene there for you.
That was in 68 now. Dibbles, we took him to London. You know, and we were supposed to play the Albert Hall. And Frank Zappa had played prior to us and tore the place up. And so they wouldn't let us play. So we thought we'd protest. We got a donkey, rented a donkey, took him up to take pictures in front of our statue. And as we approached the statue, the donkey took a dump right on the steps. Dibbles, being a ham, always loved to be the center of attraction. So he saw everybody laughing at the donkey, walk right up in front of all the cameras, New Music Express and all that, and did the same thing. He was so cute. We carried him on the plane. People let him ride in first class, because he would curtsy. And you could talk on the phone. He knew how to be a ham. They literally let us have him on the plane.
I hope that was an unintended pun there, that the piglet was
the
ham. What has been hard on you, and you talk about it pretty bluntly in the book, is the drug use. I mean, it was part of the rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah, I'm right. And, you did that in the 60s. I think we were sanctioned by the mission, the Vietnam War. That's the only thing that I can see that would allow you to be as silly as... And it was real. Peace and love, people meant that.
Yeah.
They meant that. And you have to have some kind of blessing from that to go through all the fun we went through, taking acid. But that ended with Woodstock. I see now. I didn't know then. But I know we stopped doing acid 70. It just wasn't acid anymore. It was commercial, whatever they would sell you to get you... hallucinating. That, to me, I didn't pay any attention. We started cocaine, which was basically a rich person drug. We didn't have that much, so it wasn't that deep. by the end of '70s, '80s, crack came along.
Right.
That was one that, looking for acid again, still, you tried everything once or twice, not Angel Dust or PCP. That was never fun, you know, and that's what acid had turned out to be, as far as I was concerned. But this, all it take was one time. And I stayed there until 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and that slowed me down from being able to take care of the business that I need. We made music. I still made Atomic Dog and
all. Which was a huge hit.
Which was a huge hit. You know, and I thought I could stop when I got a hit record or whatever. But it was hard to get records played after that.
Yeah.
You know, I had made good records, but you just don't get on the radio when you're getting past 50. I didn't realize that and how to get on the radio till a few years ago when I decided to do the book.
During this period when, you know, crack is sort of, it's got its grip on you and it's hard for you to get off, how much, this is a memoir, how much do you trust your memories of those years?
Well, like I say, if it wasn't for flashbacks, I wouldn't have no memory at all.
Yeah.
You know, but I do remember, you know what you're doing and what you ain't doing. You might choose to call it something else at that time. You know what I'm saying? And since I thought I could make records pretty good, and I could, that wasn't the only criteria that I should have been looking at. I should have been looking at that if I'm paying all this money to get, you know, messed up, then you're going to mess up things that you're dealing with.
Although, as you mentioned, you know, this is the time where you, as George Clinton, not Parliament, not Funkadelic, but George Clinton, you have the hit song with Atomic Dog.
Right.
Which, you know, comes from this album that did pretty well, the record Computer Games, 1982. Let's hear a little bit from George Clinton.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. But the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, kind dog, funky dogs, nasty dogs.
Bit of Atomic Dog from George Clinton, 1982 hit for him. Parliament, Funkadelic, the whole P-Funk universe giving way to a solo career. And even here, though, I mean, anybody who was a fan of P-Funk, you know, there's a certain loose-limbed quality to your music, to the way the rhythm is so steady but elastic at the same time. This is also the time where hip-hop is beginning to emerge.
Yeah, that was our intention. When we did Atomic Dog, we had already begun to hear a little bit of the sampling and how songs were loose and disjointed from connecting grooves together, overlapping samples with each other, that we literally very early caught on to that and tried to do a song like that that sounded electronic. You know, we had already done Flashlight with synthesizers, so we pretty much knew the synthesized sounds of the thing. We did Atomic Dog intentionally trying to sound like what a hip-hop record. And if you've seen heard some of the old versions of Atomic Dog, the B-side of it was actually us trying to rap. Mm. It sounded more like Sugar Hill Gang and you know, the early rap, you know.
Right, right.
But we actually did that as part of the remix of that song.
So when hip-hop began, did you see it as a threat to the kind of funk brand that you had established for so many years?
No. By then, I had already learned clearly in my mind that whatever kids was doing, it was time for you to get out of there if you're old and don't know how to adjust your thing with the kids and become part of it. I knew that, so I had no problem with them sampling. Matter of fact, early on, I did an album called Sample Some of Disc and Sample Some of That and gave them chopped up parts of Atomic Dog and Flashlight. I knew that was the new thing, and I was glad to hear it coming out, because this is a way for us to stay around.
Right. And to stay relevant.
Stay
and
relevant,
young,
yeah.
The just young be, kids through
just,
their...
Just be a part of what they're doing.
Yeah. So for in 1989, De La Soul samples your band Funkadelic, Knee Deep, on their album 3 Feet High and Rising.
It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. Just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I.
What was your, I mean, when you, the first time you heard that, what did you think?
Well, by then, my kids had told me, Dad, Granddad, I had my grandkids, I had my kids all listening to hip-hop at that time. They use the record for intros, they say, and they start a song off, and they use your record, and then another song come in. They was doing that in the clubs already. I'd seen it. But when they did it in, as a record, they actually gave me $100,000 prior to me even hearing it. So by the time I heard their version, I was already in love with it. I could see that this was going to be something new. I should have never told the publisher and the record company, because after that, they intervened, and we never saw the money again. Any of it. We got that first $100,000, and that was it.
Sadly, it becomes a theme in a lot of music memoirs, the kind of missed opportunities to make the money you thought you were going to make because the industry is built not to give you that money.
No, right, right. They go to school to learn how to take it from you.
The book is called Brothers B. You're Like George. Ain't That Funkin' Kinda Hard on You?
And you say that good. Most people can't say it.
As you might imagine, it is a book full of tall tales and definitely worth checking out. George Clinton, a real pleasure to have you with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It ain't so hard, it ain't so strange. If I could be funky like you.